Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts upon it. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And today we're going to be speaking with Dr. Joan Maloof, who is a professor emeritus at Salisbury University and founder of the Old Growth Forest Network. Dr. Maloof has recently written a book titled Nature's Temples, A Natural History of Old Growth Forests, and we will be speaking with her about the book and her research into old growth forests. Then Dr. Carrie Cook joins us. Cook is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, teaching graduate atmosphere and ocean dynamics, as well as global warming courses in the Department of Geological Sciences. Cook has written the book Climate Dynamics and is publishing a second edition of the book this year. All that and more happening on This Green Earth. Stay with us. Welcome back to This Green Earth. Our first guest today is Dr. Joan Maloof, who has been researching old growth forests and has written a book titled Nature's Temples, A Natural History of Old Growth Forests. Joan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you, Claire.
Well, first off, what we like to do is get to know our guests a little bit better. So why don't you tell us about your background?
Well, I was always a lover of plants all through my whole life. So, of course, when I went to university, I studied plant science and then environmental science and eventually ecology. And I taught biology and environmental studies for many years. And as my time researching forests and teaching went on, I just got more and more interested in the forest ecosystem, which of course is more than just the trees. It's all the things that live in the forest too. And as I really began to appreciate the forest ecosystem for how important it is, I started to realize how threatened it is as well. And that's what started me in my journey to begin to write books about what's happening in the forest and why we need to make sure that we keep some of these beautiful green old forests on our planet.
Absolutely. Well, first off, I want to get a little bit of a definition for what qualifies a forest to be called an old growth forest.
Yes, so there's no one exact definition, and there's many different forest types across the country, so you can't even put one certain age on it. Like if you say, oh, by the time the trees are 150 years old, they're old growth. Well, that wouldn't really work for the redwoods, which are still young at 150 years old. So I like to think of it as just forests that are left alone to do whatever they would do without any interference. And sometimes that interference comes in big storms or in fires, but sometimes the interference comes in humans cutting those forests down. So if you imagine a forest that's just left alone to do what a forest does for many, many years, it will develop certain qualities and characteristics, and that's what I consider an old growth forest.
So standing today, how many old growth forests do we have in the United States?
In the nation, it is estimated that in the western U.S., there's only 4% of our original forests remaining that have never been cut. And in the east, that estimate is only 1% left.
Wow. So is this mostly due to the human hand? Is this mostly us that are going through and taking these forests down?
Yes, it absolutely is. We have the largest effect on the forest. So sometimes there'll be windstorms or even some mixed severity fires that'll come through, but the forest can recover fairly easily from that. It's still got the soil layer intact. It still has the animals that live there mostly. But when we go in and do a clear cut, often we're not letting that forest grow back to be what it was before. Perhaps we're turning it into an industrial forest where it's growing just one certain type of tree for our use. And that is never going to be an old growth forest again, the same way it was before.
that complexity, the biodiversity component then plays an important role in defining a forest as quote unquote old growth. Not just the fact that you have certain trees there that are 80 or 100 years old, you have an ecosystem that is old growth in nature.
Well, that's exactly what my book is about. So when we look for old growth forests, we're looking at the trees and we're looking at the structure in the forest, but we can't always see all those little organisms, all the wildflowers, all the fungi, all the lichens, all the mosses, all the insects. So for my book, I turned to the specialists in each of those fields and looked at what they had studied. And any time they studied an old growth forest and compared it to a younger forest, maybe one managed through cutting, what did they find out? Well, over and over again, we find out that in the old growth forests, there is more of the species they studied and more diversity in those species. So for instance, salamanders, more salamander species, more of them in the old growth forest, and same with fungi, and on and on and on. So when we disturb those old growth forests, we're really changing that biodiversity and reducing it.
Right, so then the idea that, you know, a logging company can go in and log out pines and spruces and replant, and hey, you know, in 10 or 20 or 30 years from now, these pines will be back. That's not it. That's just it. That's a monoculture type of ecosystem.
That's right. And there are some organisms that are going to just disappear if you come in and change it that way. For instance, there was someone who studied snails, and he found that there were certain micro snails, they're tiny, that are only going to be found in old growth forests. And once you go in there with the logging equipment, you'll never find those snails again. And things like orchids, the orchids depend on the ants to move those seeds around, or the fungi in the soil. So once you disturb that forest, we have never seen a forest recover completely in the wildflower species after logging.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because we just had a conversation about adaptability and different species and how some species have an easier way of adapting to changes in their ecosystem and in their environment, and others do not. And it sounds like some of these species in the old growth forests, they rely so much specifically on what they're bringing to the ecosystem that even adapting to it might not be something that they can do. So we are losing some species. I'm also curious about the root system, because we talk about how that's a connection and a communication between these trees. So I'm curious about the old growth root system as compared to the younger trees and how they communicate, or what that looks like underneath.
Yeah, so we're just learning about these mycorrhizal connections, the fungal connections that the trees have underground to each other, right? And the older a tree is, the more connections it can make to the other trees. And it can actually communicate in a way through those connections, and it can help the younger trees grow. The older trees are actually helping the younger trees. So if we're cutting out half of those trees, then those connections are severed as well, or the whole forest. Imagine how long it would take for that to recover. And to your question about organisms that some do well with humans, some very well with humans, in fact, better than they do in the wild. But other organisms need these wild spaces. So ecologists say, if you want to know if an organism's going to be successful or not, look at how it interacts with humans. And if it does well, then it's not in trouble. But if it doesn't do well with human interruptions, then it's in trouble.
Well, in a warming world, what are the impacts upon these old growth ecosystems? I want to refer to them now as with respect to not just rising temperatures, but season changes in seasons and changing hydrologic cycles, you know, rainfall patterns, snow patterns, and storm intensities, et cetera, go.
Yes. And the invasive species from other places, you know, the list just goes on and on. These forests really are up against it in a lot of ways. And so for those reasons, we want to be as gentle to them as we can. You know, it's not like, oh, we can cut this forest out and it'll just recover like it used to be. No, these last older forests have some very important genetic components to them, genetic history, if you will. A lot of them have lived through hundreds or even thousands of years of environmental change. So they've been through droughts and they've been through floods, and there is some flexibility there in those old forests that we don't have in the forests that are younger and just trying to recover. So in a warming world, yes, it's not even just the temperatures that are changing, but we have these, the unpredictable rainfall is really a challenge for these forests. So you'll have these long droughts, but then all of a sudden you'll have this flood where it's just washing out. And also the windstorms have been getting more intense, and the intense winds spread the fires. So anything we can do to help these forests, you know, by leaving as many as possible to play out their ecological processes is for the better.
Yeah, I'm curious too about the carbon storage between an old growth forest and then a young forest. Is there a discrepancy in that?
Oh, massive. So the old growth forest hold the most carbon, and this is also talked about in my book, Nature's Temples, because these trees, they continue to grow for their entire lives. They're not like us. We get to a certain height and we stop, but they keep growing and growing and growing, and not just height and girth, but the carbon is stored in all of those twigs and leaves and underground. When you think about that root system underground of those old trees, 45% of the carbon in a tree is, well, 45% of the carbon in a forest is stored in the soil. A lot of it from those old tree roots, but also in the fungi that are connected to the tree roots, because carbon is what the trees are taking out of the atmosphere and handing over to the fungi, because they can't absorb their own carbon and make their own sugars like the trees do. And those tree roots underground and the mycorrhizae, they're feeding a whole ecosystem of underground creatures that we hardly know anything about. So taking the carbon out of the air and storing it. So once we cut those forests, we're not only preventing them from absorbing carbon, but we release a lot of carbon. And a study done in Oregon showed that forestry, cutting of the trees, actually releases more carbon into the atmosphere than any of these natural disturbances we talk about, like the windstorms and the fire. Hmm. So that's something we do have control over. So we like to, I started an organization called the Old Growth Forest Network. And what we do is speak out for these older forests and try to keep them standing for the carbon reasons and also for the ecosystem reasons, for all those other creatures, and can't forget the humans, for us too, right? For the beauty and the spirituality that we feel when we're in a place like that. Mm-hmm. So many reasons to keep them.
We often speak about that on our podcast, about the holistic effects that nature can have on a person, not only on our health and well-being, but really emotionally what they bring to us. And the connection that a lot of people feel to trees is this real connection of when you think about getting out into a forest and how it feels to take a deep breath, and what your body does amidst all of them. And I feel like we sometimes forget that there is such a connectivity between us and the trees, that when we try to change what's happening with the trees, it's really in turn directly affecting us, and maybe getting into some of those management issues and even talking about wildfire mitigation. How do you feel about, you know, when people are going in and saying it's for our greater good to thin, it's for our greater good to do these things? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you put so beautifully what these forests mean to us and the effects that they have on us and our bodies, you know, the health effects and the mental effects. And when you walk into one of those places where they've been doing the cutting for wildfire mitigation, you don't have to do the research. You can just feel that that forest is not the same forest as it was. It's not as healthy to our bodies. It's not as beautiful. It doesn't have the biodiversity. So I am against that sort of wildfire mitigation. We also find that it doesn't really work, that a lot of times that thinning for mitigation actually makes the forest drier. It allows more wind to go through. Often these fires are spreading building to building, not really through the forest per se. So if it worked, I might be in favor of it, but I'm not seeing any evidence that it really makes a big difference. So for that reason, I say we shouldn't be doing it because it does affect the health and beauty of the ecosystems.
You mentioned that at least out west here in Utah, et cetera, and Northwest, so we're down to about 4% of the original estimate of acreage of old growth forest. Is it possible through conservation and preservation to not just maintain us at 4%, but maybe get to 5 or 6%? I mean, can we reestablish in some ways old growth ecosystems and forests?
Wouldn't that be wonderful? That's my goal, to not only stop the destruction of the older forest, but to let some older forests, maybe they've been cut in the past, but perhaps they've been in recovery for 80, 100, 150 years, to let's not cut them again so they can become old growth once again, because, you know, they can eventually heal, we hope, you know, give them some time. So that we not only stop the destruction, but we can actually bring back some of that. Imagine if our generation could do that. And so in the Old Growth Forest Network organization, what we try to do is identify one forest in each county that won't be cut again, open to the public, relatively accessible, protected from logging. So not every county has an old growth forest. So we have to, in many cases, identify a older forest, a second growth forest, we call it, but make sure it's protected from logging so it can become old growth again in the future. We call them our future old growth forests. So that is our goal. It's a challenge. I don't know if we can do it, but imagine if we all had that goal and shared it. We could leave behind more older forests for the future instead of less.
Who is in this network? Who is working with you in this Old Growth Forest Network?
Well, I started it myself, but eventually we've been with the generous donations that have come in from individuals and small family foundations, we've been able to hire a few more people. So now we have 5 full-time people and 4 part-time people. We have regional network managers, just a few of them across the country. We're just hiring one now for out west. And what they do is work with a volunteer from each county, and that person is looking around their county to find, oh, is there an older forest here? Is there a forest that's protected or needs to be protected? And once that volunteer identifies it and works with the organization, and we decide it's protected, then we dedicate it into our network of forests that are all across the country. We have 277 forests now in the Old Growth Forest Network in 39 different states. And Utah has one forest in the network so far. So we would love to have more volunteers across Utah looking and nominating forests for the Old Growth Forest Network. Anyone can nominate a forest through our website, which is oldgrowthforest.net.
So as you go into communities and you speak and you're doing these books and these writings to educate people about what is happening currently in our forests, what are some of the biggest takeaways that you hope people glean from that? Or what are action items that people can take? You said we can nominate forests. What are some other things that we as citizens can do to help people care about what's happening in our forests?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you happen to own a forest, that's a good place to start by how you treat your own particular forest. Are you going to leave any of it uncut? And so often people are approached by the forest industry representatives and said, oh, you need to manage your forest and it should be on this sort of a rotation schedule. Well, I ask those forest owners to educate themselves, and we'll help them with that and let them know that you really don't have to manage your forest for it to be ecologically healthy. Now, if you want the most income from it, that's a different story. Then you might need to manage it. But just to have a healthy forest, the healthiest one is one that's left alone. So that's one place. Another place is just wherever you live, look around your community. Where are the forests closest to you? Who owns them? Is it government owned? In that case, talk to the government representatives, get on the list, speak out about how they're managed, or if they're privately managed or owned, let that person who owns it know how special and important that forest is. Maybe even try to get it transferred over to become a public forest someday, perhaps a park. That's one of the things I'm doing right here. I live in a small town. Our town doesn't own any forest land, but there's forest land around us that's being developed or cleared or managed. So I think, well, we need to have our own forest that we can protect, our own community forest. So we also have those different levels of identification in the Old Growth Forest Network. We identify community forests and also private forests that people have decided not to cut. So there's so much to do, so many places that we can start.
I know the government identifies, among other things, national wilderness areas. And actually in Summit County here in Utah, there is, in the eastern part of the county, there's a large tract of national wilderness area. Is that an example of at least the potential for a old growth setting to be restored, or at least on the right path to being restored or preserved?
Yes, the wilderness areas in our country are very important. And they're some of the most protected land, and some of our forests in the Old Growth Forest Network are in the wilderness areas. But we like to pick a region of the wilderness area that's pretty accessible to people. You know, not something you have to hike into for half a day, but something that you can park, maybe has a trail, and appreciate that wilderness area. The wilderness areas are also so strongly protected because it took an act of Congress to protect them. And so it's going to be very difficult to remove those protections. But not all places in the country have national wilderness areas. For instance, where I am in Maryland, we have no national forest and we have no national wilderness area. No. So we can't just rely on those and say, oh, that's enough. We need to have additional areas protected.
Right. Okay.
Well, Joan, thank you so much for joining us today and enlightening us about what is happening with our old growth forests, what it means to be an old growth forest, and how maybe we can act to preserve them. Where would people go to learn more about you and your writing? And then again, that website for the Old Growth Forest Network.
My name is Joan Maloof, and do you have a website, joanmaloof.com? I have 6 books that are out now, most of them on forests. And I do a lot of speaking around the country. If you are interested in my speaking schedule, you can go to the Old Growth Forest Network website, which is oldgrowthforest.net. And also, if you sign up to be on the email list there, if we do have a forest dedication in your area, we will email you and we'll invite you to that, and you can hike through the forest with us, or you can go to the website, nominate a forest, or just see where all those other 277 forests are. A lot of people might be taking a trip to an area and say, oh, where's an old growth forest I can visit there? And that's on the website too.
Perfect.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being part of this Green Earth today. We sure do appreciate you being a part of it.
Thank you for the invitation.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts upon it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And joining us is Dr. Carrie Cook. She is a professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at the University of Texas at Austin. And she's here to talk about her new book called Climate Dynamics. And it's the second edition of her book. We'll get into that in a minute. First, Dr. Cook, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thanks for having me.
Well, in the book, the book, as I read it here, is dedicated to the climate scientists who have worked diligently for decades to inform and educate about the dangerous reality of greenhouse gas-induced climate change. So I don't want to go back too far into, you know, explaining greenhouse gases. I think we all finally understand what the greenhouse gases are. But the questions and pushback I get from my most humble opposition at times is the following. First, why does a carbon dioxide molecule absorb heat or infrared radiation more than, say, an oxygen molecule or a nitrogen gas molecule? So we'll start with that one. Can you help explain that
The absorptive properties of a molecule depend on its molecular structure. There are certain modes of vibration and rotation each molecule can do based on its molecular structure. And those modes, they can be like almost like flapping your arms, for CO2, or they're rotational modes, that kind of thing. And these things, these modes are triggered only by radiation of certain wavelengths. And any molecule that we call a greenhouse gas, any molecule can absorb in what we call the long wave, or as you said, the infrared part of the spectrum. And that's important because the energy emitted from the surface of the Earth up towards space to cool itself is just in these infrared wavelengths. And so the greenhouse gases, again, by their molecular structure, can intercept and block some of this outgoing infrared radiation.
So then compare that to an oxygen molecule, O2, it's two oxygen atoms combined. I'm guessing that they're very symmetrical in nature compared to CO2, which has an asymmetrical
Yeah, that's part of it, and it just that difference, and others lead the oxygen molecule to be able to absorb different wavelengths.
Different wavelengths. And then methane, also a greenhouse gas,
Yes.
quote unquote potent greenhouse gas,
Yes.
absorbs even more.
More per molecule,
More per
about
molecule.
200 times more per molecule.
Okay, so that's why CO2 and methane are quote unquote greenhouse gases, whereas oxygen and nitrogen and other gases are not so much.
Right.
Now, the next,
Yeah.
okay.
Oxygen and nitrogen are pretty much inert in terms of their ability to interact with long wave radiation, even short wave or the sun's radiation.
Yeah, which is a really good thing, Dr. Cook, because what, they make up like 98% of all the molecules floating around in the atmosphere?
Exactly. And compare this with the Venus atmosphere, which is chock full of greenhouse gases, mainly CO2. And surface temperatures are, hundreds of degrees Fahrenheit, 700 Kelvin, which is probably about 1,000, I don't know, 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, because of this incredibly strong greenhouse effect on the planet Venus.
All
We
right, so
don't
that,
have that.
okay, so that kind of seg good. That kind of segues to the next question I get, of course, is the concentration. So when we started this green Earth 18 years ago, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was about, I think it was like 360 parts per million or so. And now it's roughly 416, 418 parts per million. And of course, the pushback I get there is like, that's such a small concentration, 0.04%. How can that possibly have an impact on our climate at those tiny concentrations?
Well, my first kind of glib response to that is there's a whole lot of molecules in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So even a small percent is a large number of molecules. But then a more quantitative way that I can approach that is by talking about the natural greenhouse effect. We have another one of the greenhouse gases that we haven't mentioned yet is water vapor. And of course, water vapor, as well as CO2, of course, occur naturally in the atmosphere. But the strongest greenhouse effect comes from water vapor in the atmosphere. And that's part of the natural greenhouse effect. And if we had no greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the average, globally average surface temperature would be minus 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit. Ice covered Earth. Ice ball Earth. But today, the globally average surface air temperature is at around 58 degrees Fahrenheit, which of course allows life to develop on the planet and vegetation to sustain everything.
You're in Austin, and I believe it actually passively snowed in Austin a few weeks ago, or at least Houston got a big snowstorm. And of course, Dallas, San Antonio, large parts of Texas got a very damaging snowstorm. And so that's the next pushback I get. It snowed in Austin. How can the planet be warming when we're seeing, snowfall in New Orleans? And actually, I try to explain, no, that's actually a result of climate change. Please help me supplement my
Sure.
response.
In general, climate gets more variable as it warms up, lots more energy and a more variable climate. So that is one thing to think about. In particular, for these winter storms that it can break out and come reach all the way down to New Orleans or Austin for that matter. We only got a half an inch. It wasn't anything
Right.
crazy in Austin, but New Orleans certainly was. But we had a big snowstorm here, of course, was it 2021, which we during COVID, which we call Snowvid, which people died. We had temperatures in the single digits for days when our grid failed. And a lot of these are outbreaks from the Arctic. And there's a jet stream that forms in middle latitudes, like the northern tier of the United States on average, going from west to east, a very strong jet stream. And when that jet stream breaks down, then the cold Arctic air can break out and come south.
Okay.
These are called these Arctic outbreaks. And global warming is weakening that jet stream. And the reason that is happening is because the Arctic is warming up much faster than the lower latitudes. And the jet stream forms because of the big temperature difference between the Arctic and, say, the equator. We're weakening that temperature difference from the equator to the pole, weakens the jet stream, and can allow more Arctic outbreaks.
So kind of weakening in maybe the jet stream is slowing, and as if it moves a little slower or weaker, it like a slow moving river, it has a tendency to meander more. So it has deeper troughs and maybe higher peaks to it, whereas a fast moving river just travels in one.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. Or it's really not a continuous stream all the time. And so you can have more breaks in the stream.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so, you know, as a consequence of the warming of the planet as a whole, we could get more, and we do get more, we will get more of these winter outbreak storms into lower latitudes.
Okay, thank you.
When you're balancing how the Earth is naturally reacting to these gases and what's naturally occurring in the Earth and what we're producing as humans, and you think about the connectivity of all of that, do we get back to a balance? Is that what we're looking to do? Or are we just adapting to this new way? And how are we, where do we get to, what can we do to normalize this a little bit more?
Well, to come back to the old balance, to me, my opinion here, but to me seems like that would be a pretty heavy lift.
Mm-hmm.
When we release a CO2 molecule into the atmosphere, on average, it stays there for 100 years. So I guess we could stop burning fossil fuels and wait it out. Or the other option is, of course, to mechanically draw down CO2 levels in the atmosphere. But we don't, you know, have the ability to do that yet. So we are committed to, even if we stop burning fossil fuels tomorrow, which of course is not going to happen, but even if we did, we still have elevated CO2 levels in the atmosphere, and they would only, and theoretically, we don't understand, you know, the perturbed balance, but theoretically, it would go down slowly then over the next century or two. So we are committed to a climate change. And the effort is to have that just not get too crazy high. We're already adapting, we all are. But it just gets more and more warmer, more and more variable climate. Sea level keeps rising, storms keep intensifying, droughts keep getting stronger and expanding. So, you know, where's the line? I don't know where the line is. I would have drawn the line 20 years ago, maybe. Yeah, don't know where that line is. That's up to policymakers and the voters.
We're speaking with Dr. Carrie Cook. She is a professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at the University of Texas at Austin. And we're talking about her book, Climate Dynamics, which is the second edition. The first edition, I believe Dr. Cook, was released back in July of 2013. Here we are roughly 12 years later. What changes to the book, or what were important things that you learned over these past 12 years that resulted in the second edition?
Well, I've learned about what makes a better book, first of all, for the students, and the first thing on my list was to get color figures because the students did not like black and white figures.
Okay.
And so for the old edition, I kept a website with all the color figures, but you know, I was just trying to keep the cost of the book down. So the new book is all color figures. And then I've also expanded some of the material about the physical processes that that lead to changes in the cryosphere, which is the snow and ice cover of the Earth. So some of the physical processes leading to changes in Arctic sea ice and ice in the Antarctic, that kind of thing. Expanded the section on precipitation processes because the intensification of storms is such an important element in thinking about climate change impacts. So that was changed as well. And in addition, in the original edition of the book, I did not include very much about current observations of the changing climate system, because I thought, well, you know, that's going to, you know, make the book dated in a year or two. Everything's changing so quickly. But this time I just went for it, and I added lots of sections, lots of figures about the observed changes in the climate system. And then I'll support that with an online site where I just keep updating those figures every year as things continue to change.
Now, I just read this morning that January of 2025 was the warmest January on record, quote unquote. 2024 was the warmest year on record, which surpassed 2023, the previous record holder. And we're almost falling into a state of, boy, warming is occurring almost on a linear basis. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, is it safe to say that the 10 warmest years have all occurred within the last 12 or 15 years?
I think so. Yeah, probably. Yeah. I don't, you know, I know a website to go check that, but it's something like that for sure. Yep. And I'm not sure that the current really elevated warming that we've seen in the last 2+ years, I'm not sure we clearly understand it. And this year we have a cooling event happening, which is known as La Nina, in the Pacific. And usually you see the warming doesn't happen smoothly. Some years, you know, it jumps ahead. Some years it goes behind. It's a very sawtoothy kind of a curve going up, because superimposed on the greenhouse gas force trend is natural variability, of course. Mm-hmm. And the extra warm years are usually the El Nino years, which are the years where it's warm in the Pacific sea surface. And usually the relatively cooler years are those where we have a La Nina, which are cool events in the large expanse of the tropical Pacific. But this year, with a La Nina setting up, a cool event, we still have a very, very warm January. So it'll be interesting to see. Now the energy from that. The way to think about this with the El Nino and La Nina is it's a coupled oscillation of the Earth atmosphere system. So when there's an El Nino and there's a lot of warmth in the tropical Pacific, there's extra energy, extra warmth, higher temperatures in the atmosphere and not in the oceans. And when we have a La Nina, when it's cool at the ocean surface, it just means, I mean, the heat is all still there, you know, it's just in the ocean, it's not in the atmosphere. So the ocean heat content, which we call it, just keeps going up and up and up.
I was just curious about the students, and as they are experiencing your teaching and this book, it seems interesting to me, if you go back to maybe when you were studying this or when we were studying these topics, we weren't directly experiencing it in a way that the students are experiencing it now. Because, for instance, last week in Utah, we were in negative degrees overnight, single digits. It was very cold. And just a few days ago, we were almost in the 60s here in Park City. How are you seeing this changing, how students are absorbing this or learning about this as they are directly experiencing it instead of just reading about it in a book?
I've been teaching a course similar to this for probably 25, 30 years. First at Cornell, and then when I, for 20 years, and then here at UT for 15. And what I found really interesting is the changing reasons why students want to study the topic of climate change and understand how the climate works and why it's changing. It used to be when I would ask the students, why are you here? What are you hoping to get out of this class? They would say things like, well, I read in, you know, I hear all this stuff that maybe the climate's warming, maybe it isn't warming. Is it a problem or is it not a problem? I want to understand the science behind that so I'll know what the truth is. Nobody says that anymore. They're all on board, as most of the public is as well, the general public. What they want to do is learn about climate, how climate works, because they feel they'll be better advocates for advocating for how climate works, for climate policy, coherent and scientifically defensible climate policy. And they all know that this is going to affect them for the rest of their lives. Even if they're pre-med, there's lots of health climate issues arising. If they're going to be lawyers, there's environmental law issues that are going to constantly arise. Hydrologists, whatever field they're in, this is going to be affecting them for the rest of their lives. And they understand that very clearly.
Yeah, you can add the psychology department to that too, because I know after some shows Claire and I have, we feel like we should head right off to therapy. Because it comes, well, quite honestly, it becomes quite overwhelming and can get kind of emotional at times.
I agree. And my students sometimes ask me, how do you stay cheerful?
Exactly. I wanted to get back into the components that you cover in the book that are influenced by a warming world. You mentioned a few, you know, there's the atmospheric changes, there's changes in our ocean currents, there's changes in the hydrologic or water cycles around the planet, the cryosphere, changes in the cryosphere. Which one do you think is at most risk or is changing the most? Is there a one or is it all tied for one first?
Well, it's hard to compare them. It's a little bit apples and oranges, because for the atmosphere, you're talking about temperature. For the Arctic, you're talking about sea ice. For Antarctic, you're talking about glaciers and ice shelves. Mm. But I think most people would agree it's the Arctic kind of winds, if that's the right word. Wins the prize. We've lost so much sea ice, and it's making it, you know, it, once you melt snow and ice, you expose the dark ocean surface and you absorb more solar radiation, and it just amplifies. And of course, as we talked about earlier, there are global consequences for that. So the Arctic sea ice is probably the most drastic change of all the changes that are happening now.
Yeah, we have a representative on periodically from the National Snow and Ice Data Center to give us an update on Arctic sea ice minimum and maximum. And he is he's pretty confident that we may see an quote unquote open North Pole, ice-free North Pole at its minimum, you know, September or so, within the next 15 years or so, which, you know, again, a conversation we had 12 years ago, he was saying, well, maybe by 2075, we might see an open North Pole. And that's what I see is like there's this blue shift of change coming on where it's everything that we thought was going to happen at the end of this century is slowly getting moved up on our schedule.
Yes.
Are you
yes.
seeing that too?
It is. And sometimes I wonder, Well, I think it's mostly because of the sea ice, and it has been a difficult thing to put into our climate models. So the melting of the Arctic ice, what and it, the speed with which it is melting was missed by the climate models 20 years ago, because as you might imagine, we don't have a lot of data about large-scale melting in that region until recently, of course. And so it was very hard to formulate these processes in the models. So that one definitely was underestimated by the climate models, not now, but you know, in the past yeah. decades. Yes.
Okay.
And so it does seem like it's galloping toward us at an accelerating pace for sure.
Okay. Well, again, the name of the book is Climate Dynamics, second edition. The author is Dr. Carrie Cook. She's the professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at the University of Texas at Austin. Dr. Cook, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.